The Keeneland Spring Meet continues through April 23rd, featuring six stakes this weekend, including the 300,000 Maker's Mark Mile, which is a grade one on Friday, and the 300,000 Coolmore Jenny Wiley, which is also a grade one on Saturday. Keeneland offers big pools and full fields for the bettors. In fact, Friday, April 9th, Keeneland offers a guaranteed pool of 200,000 for their pick four presented by TVG. On Saturday, April 10th, they'll offer a guaranteed pool of 300,000 for their all stakes pick four. The Keeneland Spring Meet goes April 2nd through the 23rd. For information, visit Keeneland.com/racing. Welcome to episode 88 of Red Board Rewind. My name is Spencer Luganbuehl, and today my special guest is someone who I think without his guidance and help in getting in the industry, this podcast probably wouldn't even be available right now. That man is Scott Shapiro. Me and Scott go over four races from last Saturday's card at Keeneland, races 4, 5, 7, and 11. And some angles that we talked about were how second-time surface and distance horses can hit the board at big odds, pressing your opinion in graded stakes with horses who have big climb class edges, and what to do next with Hidden Scroll and Scott's stable horse to look at next time. This is Red Board Rewind. It's the same old story. Now I'd like to welcome my second special guest of the day, someone who kind of got me started in my journey here in horse racing. It's Scott Shapiro. Scott, how are you today?
Doing good, Spencer. Great time of the year. We got the tournament and the Masters and great horse racing. And in less than a month, the Run for the Roses. Can't wait.
I mean, it's just, isn't it weird what last year was now compared to now? Everyone, you know, it used to be, you know, you have to wait a whole year to make sure you got back with your Derby predictions. Now we get, what is it, half a year pretty much?
Yeah, I'm purposely forgetting everything about last year's Derby. No offense to the My Racehorse people and Saratoga Stable. And it didn't happen, Spencer. It didn't happen.
I can't agree with you more there. obviously, we're back in full swing. Keeneland, one of my favorite meets. How's it been so far for you?
Not great, not terrible. Friday, I didn't really dive in that much. The first half of the card I lost. The second half of the card I wasn't really appealing to me. And then on Saturday, Bluegrass Day, which we'll talk about some of, didn't connect the dots. Had some decent opinions, but as you know, as a horizontal player, got to be able to connect the dots, and didn't really have any one horse that stood out as a horse that I liked as an A that I bet to win or anything like that. So, well, hopefully this week goes a little better, pardon me, than opening weekend.
It's so hard being a horizontal player, and, you know, unless if you have, like, that key horse right in the middle of a pick four or a pick five in, like, that second, third leg type way, it's really hard to kind of put horses together. I mean, yeah, sure, you can play doubles and stuff, and, like, that's what I always try and teach people. No need to go so far out for the pick fours and pick fives. Stick to doubles and pick threes, because I think what a lot of people try and do is they play a $65, $64 pick four, which is way above budget, and I'm like, you could also just play, you know, maybe a $32 double, and there's way less variance involved with four races compared to two.
No, very good point. Play the horizontals if you're going to play them that fit your opinions, not necessarily the sequences you want to play. And, you know, even if your opinions don't fit them. And it was a little bit difficult on Saturday. You had a heavy favorite at the end, so you don't want to go too deep in any of the other legs unless you like all prices. So connecting on that could have happened with a deeper budget. But good advice. Don't always have to play the pick four or the pick five, even if it is the most appealing wager and gives you the biggest chance to blow up. Play the wagers that fit around your opinions.
We talk so much about handicapping, and, you know, wagering always seems to get, like, you know, fleshed out. Like, oh, we should focus on it, but no one ever really does. And we talk about so many good books, you know, Dick Mitchell for me, Stephen Crist, obviously. And there hasn't really been another wagering book, Barry Meadow. How can I forget Barry Meadow? And everyone always says, like, you know, oh, the math never changes, but no one wants to learn it. Do you feel like maybe now, where the game is, we're almost ready for another wagering book with maybe a little bit more aptitude towards, like, specific bankroll styles? Because I feel like now in this time in for the game, the bankrolls where it used to be everyone kind of brought 200 and that was the main number everyone brought, there's such a wide variety now of people at the track.
Definitely, always around for a good book. The funny thing is I didn't read many of those books until very recently. However, I agree it would be great to have one of the best wagerers around write another book. The problem is make the motivation for, you know, somebody that so, you know, bets as much as the top few guys do and makes money doing that, taking time aside to write a book, I would think is a difficult venture. But I'm always here for a good book to make me better, Spencer. I know you are as well.
I think as well, too, it's kind of hard. Hey, give us all your secrets. I know you're only, right, you know, a 15% winner, but, you know, I think even with just doing the Bet Squad for a couple of years and just seeing, you know, a lot of people, they want to go, you know, right to the deep end of the pool. A lot of times they'll ask, you know, hey, can you help me figure out a good pick four, pick five sequence? And I always feel it's difficult for me. I don't really play those big pools because due to bankroll. And I just also wonder, like, everyone is so transfixed on that, you know, five-figure score. And I get it. It's your one time out. You're on vacation. You want to go to the track. You want to make, you know, that score. Do you feel like the game would be better off, like, you know, maybe showing, you know, oh, it's that pick six carryover day where you can make $1 million. And obviously they're never going to stop doing that. But maybe it's time to, you know, help the middle tier better kind of grind out a profit to where, like, they can almost beat the game, but it's kind of a 50-50 thing where it helps the track and the better as well, where they're still being able to wager and putting a ton of money into the pool, but it doesn't just seem like you're losing 9 out of 10 days.
No, I think that would be helpful, but it's obviously up to the player more than the marketing of the industry, because, you know, what one thing I feel fortunate about being a little bit older than yourself and some others is that when I got involved in the game, the horizontals weren't, you know, the bee's knees, weren't everything. And there wasn't TVG and Twitter and all these things. I kind of learned it on my own by going to the track. And yes, there were horizontal wagers, but it wasn't all in your face. And then it kind of built upon that. I remember finding out about pick threes and, you know, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. But yeah, to your point, I think a someone that wants to grind away and is concerned about long-term profitability instead of just entertainment, you know, you got to teach yourself to avoid reading what, you know, the marketing promotional emails and what TVG and whatnot are pushing on you and make the wagers that are right for you. I do think, though, from time to time, as I kind of said a little bit earlier, if your opinions fit a pick four or pick five after you've handicapped the card, I think it's a great way to attack, especially low percentage pick fives. But it's when they don't, and you end up forcing a bigger ticket than you want to try to feel good about it, that's when it ends up hurting your bankroll most, much more so than if it's actually a pick four or pick five where you have two or three strong opinions and can build around those.
Let's switch it kind of just over to Keeneland in general. Obviously, a boutique meet happens twice a year for about a month, a little bit over. Obviously, Del Mar, Saratoga, a little bit longer than that even. The level of racing is so much bigger at these specific meets. And obviously, everyone wants to play and, you know, figure out how they can be the best at that specific meet. What kind of different style do you have compared to, you know, getting ready for a Churchill Downs? Even though there is great racing at Churchill Downs, obviously, with the Derby. Is there any different approach you take to Keeneland, like a certain angle? Are you looking for certain connections differently?
I think the connections is somewhat important. I mean, overall, Keeneland and Churchill, a lot of the same guys are going to have their stock ready for it. But when I think of guys like, you know, Brad Cox, Steve Asmussen especially, he's going to win his share of races in Keeneland. But I don't think he points to that meet like he does Churchill, like he does Oak Lawn, like he does some other meets. Brad Cox probably points just about everywhere at this point when it comes to Kentucky. There are connections that certainly are more live. They might have a John Hancock who won the first race, the first baby race or one of the baby races on Friday. He probably has one or two two-year-olds he's gearing up and he knows for months or at least weeks, right, that he's going to run this horse at Keeneland as soon as possible because he wants to win a race there. Whereas you have connections, Steve Asmussen has so many good two-year-olds. I don't think he's pointing one for a specific meet. He's pointing them for when they're ready to run. So, yeah, I mean, a little bit with connections. In terms of angles, Spencer, nothing really specific. There have been many cases it feels like where outside part of the track and even off the pace has been good at Keeneland on big days, much more than other tracks, which seem to overall be speed favoring on a lot of the big days. But that's a micro concept. I don't think it's a thing I go into thinking with Keeneland. But it's just something to keep in mind. Some days that outside part of the track can be the place to be.
I love the fact that you brought up the big name trainers that obviously go around. I think, and it would be interesting to do, I almost feel like I should almost do a little YouTube thing for In the Money. If you almost go back and we could take Oaklawn, which is going to be ending soon, or any track really, even the Aqueduct meet that just ended, and looking at like those trainers in like that 7 to 15, 7 to 12 range, and really, you know, just going into Formula Air, dumping it, saying, okay, last 3 months Aqueduct, you know, where were their winners? And I guarantee you'd almost find that, you know, maybe a trainer has 7 wins and they're all in the maiden claiming ranks out of her 8 total wins. And of course, now next year, you'll go in every single maiden claiming race, you almost have to elevate that horse because you think that maybe that's where her best type of horses are for the time being at the specific meet. And I think that's something that's very key. And it's also very hard because a lot of people don't just follow one track, two tracks. And we had a great thing from Ryan McCarthy. He showed all of his different notes and stuff for Santa Anita. And just the deep dive you have to do and just the patience it takes to do all that note-taking, I can't imagine how rewarding it is when you can hit a straight pick three for, you know, 10, 20 bucks because you have certain specific angles that fit the horses that aren't the second or first choice.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. You have a huge advantage, and a lot of people that play tournaments or that like to just play where there's carryovers or where the best cards are, that's what you're missing out on if you're able to follow a track at a time and really be diligent. You've got all that time in between races to take notes. You've obviously got the off days, noting biases, noting which trainers are hot and cold, keeping those notes over the years. You will find trends that other people will not. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, a certain trainer, Chad Brown, let's use him for instance, you know, 25 to 30% type trainer. But, you know, there's times during the year where just normally he's not as good. I mean, you can point to sometimes at Gulfstream Park. He's probably not unleashing his best animals. So just in general, following a track like that is something I advise. It's not easy to do with all the options out there. But I prefer it because I think you learn the horses, you learn angles, you learn trends, you learn the connections. It's a huge advantage outside of just numbers and analytics and such.
Let's start and maybe help people make some money from this past week. And let's start off with our first race. Race number 4 from Keeneland was an N1X allowance going 1 mile on the turf. Definitely some interesting horses in here. A horse for me that I kind of liked was We the Clouds, second time turf for Timothy Ham. I've always seemingly like, I need to start looking more at distances too, where maybe it's second time route or, you know, two sprints and then stretching out into a route, which is another good angle. I definitely love second time turf. I thought this horse kind of fit based off that Tampa race where a lot of horses don't also handle Tampa, and it's also a tiring turf track. And I thought that when I looked at the top horses in this race, he wasn't that far behind these horses at all. Or she wasn't.
Yeah, for a 20-to-1 shot, not bad. Ran ahead, got beat just by a head at Tampa at a somewhat similar level. First level allowance, obviously the class level much different at Tampa than Keeneland on opening weekend. I didn't have a super strong opinion. I had 3 A's in the race, and I just used those in the horizontals with number 1, Secret Time, number 4, Vividly, and number 9, Empress Eleanor. I thought that there would be an honest early pace in here, nothing chaotic. But I landed on hoping that one of those got through, didn't make any in-race wagers, just used it as kind of a pillar in the early horizontals.
Obviously, I always like this when people make multiple A's. Was there like an A plus, A and A minus type of area there? Or was it trying to just make sure you kind of just got through the leg and used them all kind of just as equally as possible?
Yeah, I thought that the 1 was the horse to beat on the class drop, Secret Time, but it was tough to be overly confident because of just 1 race over a firm course, which is what I expected and what we got on Saturday at Keeneland. Had the 2 races over turf courses with Given Them, and then all courses with Given Them over in France. So thought Secret Time was the one to beat, but didn't want to swallow probably 3-to-1 or so on that. So that was my, you know, if I'm public handicapping, I was probably 1-9-4, but I really didn't have much separation.
One horse that I always like to kind of try and figure out what the buyer will be for this horse. And a horse like Osaka Girl went off at 7-to-1, so it wasn't a long shot. You know, it was one of those middling type horses. I just could never see this horse running better than any type of race in the 70s. And I wasn't expecting it to be a high 70. So it's kind of nice when right off the rip, you're not only eliminating horses that are, you know, double digits, you know, 30, 40, 50-to-1 shots, but you're able to just take a nice solid 7-to-1 shot out. And I just also feel a horse that we hadn't really talked about yet was Enjoy It While We Can, Maker and Rosario. Obviously very, very good. It was such an interesting fact for me. Obviously the first race on dirt, Aqueduct, no good. They bring it back twice on turf, small improvement, second and then third time out. He's had four separate riders for this horse. How hard is it, do you think, when it just seems like it's jockey musical chairs on a horse that also ends up taking a lot of money?
Yeah, that's a good call on the jockey musical chairs. I mean, with Maker, he's so willing to use so many of the top guys at each circuit that I'm not too judgmental. But at the same point, you'd like to have a jockey that knows the horse. When you go to a guy like Joel Rosario, not too big of a concern for me. But with both of those horses you mentioned, Osaka Girl and Enjoy It While We Can, the one concern I had and why they weren't tops for me is their affinity to run second when they run their race, not first. I don't necessarily think that's a happenstance. I think that happens because horses lack a will to win or an understanding of how to, you know, get to the wire first. Both of them, to me, were plays against because of that.
I always find it interesting talking to people because the way you kind of teach people the game is, oh, you want to find first, second, and thirds. But, and this is where you'll see people's eyes glaze over, you want more first than second and thirds. Obviously, Enjoy It While We Can. One win, 14 starts, 7 underneath placings. This is the exact type of horse that is going to be that underneath use for me, second-itis type horse. And I also find it, you know, it's hard because this is also the type of horse that I can see beating me every once in a while. But it's always at that weird, you know, 7-2, 5-1 price that you kind of feel icky that you didn't use. But you know that in the long run, a lot of these horses will take even more money. And it really does, I think, sometimes become price dependent. But I'm still okay not using this horse, even if they're in that solid, you know, $10 price range.
If you play scared, you're never going to win in this game. And that's easily said, not as easily done. I certainly use horses defensively and out of fear. And these horses, like you said, they're going to beat you sometimes. They're not, because they're fast enough to be there. Maybe the bet, maybe they'll get the right trip. Maybe another horse that was going to be better won't. But you got to be willing to understand that in the long run, like you said, these are probably minus EV type horses.
For Scott, it was the number one Secret Time. For me, it was We the Clouds trying to get a bomb home here in the fourth. Let's see who breaks this N1X allowance right now.
And they're off. There's Urban Fairy Tale with Osaka Girl to her inside. Those two come forward in the opening strides. We the Clouds moves up. Emily's Oasis right there as well. The fourth position as they head down to the first turn. We the Clouds, Osaka Girl back toward the rail, contest the lead. Urban Fairy Tale between that pair now goes second as We the Clouds went wide out toward the center of the course as they moved into the first turn. Now starts to regain a couple of spots, but still caught to the far outside and third by just a head. And then Emily's Oasis, hard-held, wrestled back and forth between horses, vividly moves up from fifth to her inside. Moral Reasoning hugs the rail in sixth. Fritzy is seventh. Tootsie is eighth. Hat Tip is in ninth. Secret Time is toward the back of the pack in the 10th position. Enjoy It While We Can is alongside her in 11th. Empress Eleanor, last of the 12. It was 22.79 seconds for the opening quarter, the first half mile, and 47.01 seconds. Osaka Girl, the leader. Osaka Girl leads at a length and a half. Urban Fairy Tale, second toward the outside, into the far turn. Vividly, third down toward the rail. We the Clouds, fourth up on the outside. Emily's Oasis is fifth in between horses, still tossing her head about. Tootsie moves up on her outside. Moral Reasoning there down toward the rail. Enjoy It While We Can has to go toward the center of the course, running nearly 10 lengths off the lead. Secret Time still has a lot of running to do down toward the rail as they come to the final furlong. Osaka Girl is the leader, has it a length and a half. Enjoy It While We Can to the outside. Secret Time is trapped down toward the inside, trying to find an opening. Enjoy It While We Can comes forward. Empress Eleanor is running on behind her. Enjoy It While We Can has the lead. Can she hang on? Empress Eleanor is right there on the outside. Enjoy It While We Can. Empress Eleanor, head bobbing photo for the win.
And for the first time, I believe, ever in the Red Board Rewind, we have a dead heat for first. Empress Eleanor getting it done, paying $10. And also, Enjoy It While We Can, that second highest type, paying $5.40. Thoughts on the race, Scott? Obviously, my long shot running third still paid a great $11.40. Unfortunately, I only used win place, not win place show. Shame on me.
Oh, bummer. Yeah, good call on the long shot. Yeah, this is a race that ended up collapsing with Osaka Girl on the lead and Urban Fairy Tale sitting second. Ended up being the right trip, ended up being the wide sweeping move from well off the pace. Both of the top two made that move from well out of it. couple horses that tried to move inside instead of outside from off the pace, ended up encountering traffic. So definitely a good race to use for trip notes. There should be a couple horses that maybe will get overlooked next time out. And both the top two that ran 1-2 to the wire and dead heated probably had things their way in this one.
I will say this too, for people who, you know, like to jockey bash, and I'm sure I see it all the time on Twitter. These guys are making split second decisions, and sometimes they decide to go inside, sometimes they decide to go outside. The perfect idea for me was when Irad won the Belmont on Creator and beat Dustin at the wire. That one still hurts me to this day. He had ended up splitting horses instead of going inside or outside. It just, these guys are making split second decisions, and a lot of times, you know, the reason a guy is 20% and not 15 is because he makes the right decision, you know, four out of five times, you know, 4 out of 10 times, whatever it would be. And I just think, you know, looking at this race overall, Empress Eleanor was a really big improver, 10-1, improving every start now, 69, 70, 74, 84. Enjoy it while we can at 4-1, got that nice little trip, you know, 78, 81, 84. We the Clouds didn't improve second time. So I feel like if I'd gotten that little bit of improvement, he was only 7 points off. Maybe he doesn't get the win, but maybe he can, you know, I guess it's kind of hard to say when they're dead heating, but, you know, maybe he can somehow get a little bit closer with a higher number. But a lot of people would be upset to finish third. I was hoping for improvement, but the horse still kind of showed he belonged in this high level off of, you know, coming up from Tampa, which we know is a little bit of a weaker circuit.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And you got the help of some traffic trips in there, but it was a good cap. I mean, when you're looking at 20-1 morning line shots, you're definitely going to have to be a little forgiving of some of parts of their past performances and kind of have an outlook expecting better, like you said. But good handicap by you in there. If you're looking for Empress Eleanor, who ended up getting up just in time for the dead heat, was a horse that I've had my eye on, ran a real good debut at Kentucky Downs for Nacho Correas, and kind of disappointed at Keeneland last time around, but really has kind of figured things out this time under James Graham, formerly under Brian Hernandez Jr.
It was interesting too, because obviously that race at Kentucky Downs was, you know, she was obviously very fresh. And I think that that's another thing too, is like looking at the layoffs, where are they running? You know, is it always that second or third time when they're starting to get their wins or their higher buyers? And this one ran perfectly fine first time out. And I think we're just seeing that nice improvement now, you know, 3-4, first-time four-year-olds, another really good angle that I think a lot of people forget about.
Yes, that's a very good angle. And with those angles, second, third starts of form cycles, you obviously want to keep an eye on which trainers. You know, some guys, you know, the Bob Baffert's, Chad Browns, these guys have got horses ready to rock and roll on debut. So that third and second start of the form cycle, not as important. Some of the more patient conditioners out there, those are great angles and ones where you can get good prices because people are looking at the most recent race or two and they're not as good as maybe their upside can show. So definitely worth noting that.
Let's move on to our next race, race number 5, the very next race, optional 75,000 M1X, 7 furlongs on the dirt. I kind of had the same conversation with Maggie earlier today about how 7 and 6.5, I feel like I'm looking a lot more, you know, how do they do with the distance? And obviously talking about the Carter, the top two in that race ran 1-2, who actually had victories at 7 furlongs. Is 7 and 6.5 a big deal? Do you need to see that, you know, solid performance beforehand? Or are you fine taking horses that are stretching out or maybe turning back a little bit?
No, it's definitely a unique, tricky distance, and you'll see plenty of horses that get 6, 5.5, of course, that struggle because it's a combination of stamina and speed. Mostly speed still. It's a one-turn race, but you do need more stamina. Ideally, I want horses that have proven to like the distance, 6.5, 7 furlongs. But you can also kind of figure on which horses might like it. I mean, speed horses or tactical speed horses that are coming out of mile and mile in a 16th races and cutting back are some of my favorite horses to play. And then you have the closers at those races that are going to probably be too far out of it probably to get the job done, but still could be could factor underneath. But I'm with you. It's a unique distance. Having an affinity for it is certainly an advantage.
What kind of A's and B's did you have in this race, Scott?
I had 3 A's, 5, 6, and 7. Paleo, Joe Frazier, and Warrant gave all 3 good chances. I thought they'd all be up close, prominently placed. Didn't see a ton of early speed in here. I did land on the longest shot of the 3 because of the price in number 5, Paleo, as the top pick for Michael Stidham.
What did you, now with this horse, for me, it's an automatic X out. I just didn't really, I know it's coming from Colonial. The speed figure wasn't all amazing. And obviously now switching surfaces, what kind of made the thoughts here for you?
Yeah, it just appeared to be a horse that had been training really well, breaks the maiden at 4-5. Almost indifferent to that effort, although an 82 Briz speed rating, you know, if you trust the numbers, a Colonial, not sure exactly what the buyer is. I have the Brizes in front of me, but you know, fast enough that it's not, you know, a bad, bad group. And it just looked like a horse that they had given time after an impressive effort. Something must have gone wrong, and just had a long series of drills at Fairgrounds, including a couple really quick ones. You had the 5 furlongs and 59 and 4, 4 furlongs and 48 and 1, and then they ship him up to take on this type of field. I just thought the price was going to be right to gamble on a horse like this that had done nothing wrong so far.
With this race, there was a lot of interesting thoughts for me. First of all, Founder, obviously, again, Joel Rosario, now Chad Brown. This is the one I actually ended up betting on and playing in the Daily Gallop contest. I think I just kind of rushed this thought process, because when you look at this horse, muddy race at Saratoga, breaks the maiden by a neck, then they're stretching him out to 1/16 in the grade one, then they're cutting back to 7, and then a layoff. Now it's first-time three-year-old, and maybe I just trusted in Chad too much here, and I guess I just kind of lost sight of what exactly I was trying to go for. My second choice was one that you had as well, Joe Frazier, Florent Giroux, Brad Cox. I just thought that out of all the races, obviously he had run faster than his debut, but the debut was a win. It was against maiden claiming. And Brad thought well enough of this horse to, you know, run him in the slop at Churchill Downs, then go to Remington Park, and then try that allowance race. And the allowance race, you know, he was 1 pace and 3 wide, says the comment line. I just thought that maybe the freshening, first-time three-year-old, the horse had run okay numbers as a two-year-old, that it might be a little bit interesting. The one horse that you would also like, Warrant, I did not like at all. I just thought improving in both races, but out of that maiden race, 0-6 with horses next time out. Just whenever I see that kind of 0-for number, it makes me just really, really downgrade a field, and I was not a fan. Obviously, Castellano getting on for Bridge Mahan, for some people it's a wash, maybe, but for me, Castellano is okay in this spot. Democracy was another one off the win for Pletcher. Nice bullet work as the last work. Obviously, we know how good Pletcher is with how many races he's won the last 2 weeks. And I just think overall, I kind of just muddied the surface too much in this race, and I made a bad top pick in Pounder.
Yeah, I mean, hindsight's 20/20 in this, and we'll talk about afterwards what ended up happening. But I just thought this was a race where I wanted to find a price. I saw several ways to go in terms of the likeliest to win or close there, too. So that's why I found her. Wasn't quite as appealing to me, because I knew off that big maiden win, and then you've got Mandaluna and Essential Quality winning the races after that, and it's Chad Brown and Rosario. I just knew the price wasn't going to be there. I wasn't going to be one bit surprised if this son of upstart ran him down in the lane.
For Scott, it was Paleo. For me, it was Founder. Let's see who can win this race right now.
They're off. Manitowish broke alertly from the far outside. Democracy has early speed. Paleo, Joe Frazier. Here's Joe Frazier moving up now out of a crowd into second. Manitowish has the lead, though. From the outside, starts to angle down toward the inside. Has the lead by a length and a half. Joe Frazier goes second. Warrant, third up on the outside. Paleo is fourth against the rail. Democracy, fifth in the center of the track. Notable exception, 6th between horses. 1 Fast Cat, 7th down toward the inside. Then Medicine Tail, who travels 8th, 1 lane off the rail into the far turn. Surly Furious back at the back of the pack in the 9th position, joined by Santa Cruiser to the outside, and Founder, who moves up 1 spot from last between that pair. 22.68 seconds, the time for the opening quarter. Joe Frazier, the leader. Joe Frazier leads at 3/4 of a length around the far turn. Warrant goes second by just over a length. And now Paleo taking 3rd by a head to the inside of Manitowish, who's in the 4th position. And then Notable Exception is 5th. Democracy, a wide 6th. 1 Fast Cat looking for running room. Changes lanes. Comes out from behind the front pair. Moves up to the outside, but still 3rd. 2 lengths off the front pair. You've got Warrant and Joe Frazier going at it for the lead. 1 Fast Cat tries to join them from 3rd. Medicine Tail is 4th down toward the inside. Joe Frazier and Warrant still going at it. Joe Frazier short lead. Warrant 2nd. And then 1 Fast Cat in 3rd. Joe Frazier and Warrant. Joe Frazier and Warrant down to the line. These two head-bobbing photo for the win. Either Joe Frazier or Warrant for the top spot in 122.31.
And the number six, Joe Frazier, gets it done. 2360 is the mutual. 88 buyer. I feel like a dummy, like we said, Scott. Just I had him second picked, and I used him with Founder and Exactas, and I just forget, you know, I guess the most basic rule. Why are you playing a 5-2 shot when the 10-1 shot should at least get a win bet?
Yeah, and for me, obviously the top pick didn't end up hitting the board, but the second and third did, and not having an Exacta was probably pretty silly. But yeah, I think getting back to Keeneland for Joe Frazier, getting freshened up, did the trick. Warren, obviously a very talented horse. They hit the wire together in there. If you're taking notes at home, the one horse that I thought might have been even best that I did not like at all coming into the race was One Fast Cat, the two horse that broke from the rail. I thought this horse, having followed Turfway Park, came out of one of the weaker maiden special weight races there, and there were some good ones, and was going to be drawn to the inside, taking a significant class and hike. I thought would be sent, missed the break, found a way to relax in tight along the rail during the middle part of the race, and was the best of those coming from off the pace to finish third. That'd be a horse that I'm going to keep an eye out on. Certainly took to the dirt and certainly doesn't need the lead. But yeah, Brad Cox 1-2, not that surprising, right?
I mean, not at all. In hindsight, is 2020. I will say this about One Fast Cat. It's very nice to see a guy like Deshaun Parker. When I started off playing the horses, I played a lot of Mountaineer at night, a jockey that I'm very, very familiar with, and obviously him, and then obviously Kendrick winning the Grade One and having a riding title this year. I feel like we're starting to see some really good jockeys that, you know, are just coming into their own finally on some of the biggest stages.
Yeah, Deshaun Parker, the George Wolfe Award winner, known as a very, very good guy, has been around. You mentioned Mountaineer. He rides at Indiana, rides at Turfway Park. Good to see him getting opportunities at Keeneland for Wesley Ward on top horses.
Let's move on to our next race, race number seven. It was the Grade Three Commonwealth, 7 furlongs on the dirt. I'm just going to say this, no tangent. At what point are we going to start figuring out with Hidden Scroll that this horse is a mud horse or a mud lark and just cannot run in these types of races?
Well, certainly is the case, because, I mean, that effort at Oaklawn and then the one in the slop on debut were powerful efforts. I would point to a couple other races, though, where he has run well over the main track, and maybe just suggest that he's a mental midget of some sort and just an impossible horse to back, because when he runs well, you know, it's usually at a short price because he's been training well and because of his connections and because of his, quote-unquote upside. But, yeah, I mean, Hidden Scroll, quite the enigma now in the Brad Cox barn.
For me, it was a pretty easy pick. I kind of I talked last week with Ashley Mayu about how I've been kind of an Eye of the Jedi fan, and this just screamed Eye of a Jedi 2.0 to me. Flagstaff from the rail. I mean, good Lord, consistency. I mean, won the last 10 races, all 90 buyers. Been facing some of the best horses in the world. And now I think takes that small, you know, or takes a little small jump up in class, but finally gets a graded stake type race where he kind of can control stuff, and he just seems to be, you know, the big man on the little campus.
Yeah, I didn't see it that way. Flagstaff, to me, was a horse I thought moving in the wrong direction. Had posted two, as a thoroughgraph guy, a pair of threes when he was running ones mostly last year. I saw that as a sign that maybe the gelding was running on the tail end of his career. And the blinkers back off to me suggested just that Sadler was reaching. He tried last time with the blinkers. That didn't really work. He got third, although it was a good third to Hot Spring in the Hot Springs to CZ Rock and Winmore. I just thought he was worth a horse worth a chance against. I landed on number five, Attachment Rate. I was concerned there wasn't going to be enough speed for the Son of Hard Spun, but I really like this horse's most recent races, including on dirt, that is, including the well-off-the-pace win at Gulfstream against Lesser. Thought he ran okay in the Discovery and ran very well at Churchill Downs on October 29th. So I was hopeful, maybe more so than anything, that the pace would be hotter than I expected, but I think Attachment Rate was a horse maybe moving in the right direction.
I can't agree with you more there. To me, he just kind of seemed like the quintessential, you know, top allowance type that's going to need to kind of have a race go his own way to break through that graded stake ranking. But I can totally see what you liked in there. And you got an absolutely decent price on this horse as well, off of 5-1 morning line.
Yeah, I mean, price always key here. Louis Saez was picking up the mount. You mentioned, you know, before third start of the form cycle can often be a solid angle. However, when they, you know, make a big breakthrough off the bench, although the numbers, I guess, from the February 27th race were similar to the fall races of last year. But yeah, price was right, and I think attachment rate has some upside.
For me, it was Flagstaff. For Scott, it was attachment rate. Let's see if we can get the grade three here right now.
We're off in the Commonwealth. There goes Special Reserve out for the lead. Flagstaff is there toward the inside. These two come forward. Bango away running in the third position, tries to join them, and shifting lanes now toward the far outside. Special Reserve, the early leader, three quarters of a length. Flagstaff goes second by just a head. Bango right alongside of that one, a close third. Mucho is fourth out in the center of the racetrack, a length and a half off the leader. And then Hidden Scroll, who is taken under a hold back in the fifth position from in between horses, a lane off the rail to the far turn. Hog Creek Hustle outside of that one, and Attachment Rate trails. Opening quarter went to 22.98 seconds. Into the far turn, Special Reserve leading at three quarters of a length. Bango is second by a neck. Mucho third up on the far outside. Flagstaff comes next. Hidden Scroll fifth in between horses. Three lengths off the front trio as they come to the quarter pole. Hog Creek Hustle, attachment rate at the back. Here's Mucho on the outside. Tries to put a head in front. Bango fights on between horses. Special Reserve back toward the rail is still there as well. The front three in a line coming to the eighth pole. And then Flagstaff, who switches lanes toward the outside, center of the track, three lengths away, and fourth. It is Special Reserve with the lead. Flagstaff coming from the outside. Bango toward the inside. Flagstaff is running after Special Reserve. Flagstaff running by Special Reserve. Flagstaff to win the Commonwealth for Joe Elbersario. Close for second, either attachment rate or others in that runner-up photo. 121.84 for the seven furlongs, Flagstaff.
And the number one, Flagstaff, finally gets it done, paying 580, 94 buyer. Special Reserve, 10-1 shot, runs second. Your attachment rate at 6-1, very solid price. 90 buyer for him off the 93 last time. I wouldn't really call it a regression. I feel like he kind of just ran the same kind of race.
Yeah, we're talking Flagstaff or Special Reserve, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, attachment rate.
Oh, yeah, attachment rate. Yeah, no, he ran his race. He just needed a collapse, like you said before that. Before we listen to the race call, you know, he needs things probably to go his way to win a race in the graded stakes ranks. But definitely a nice horse that could still be moving forward. We'll see what Dale Roman does with him in his fourth start of the year.
To me, the top three, this kind of reminded me so much of a grade three where Flagstaff ran 94 compared to a 95. Special Reserve ran 91 to a 94. No one really improved. The biggest improver was, I mean, obviously Mucho from a 67 to an 87 buyer. Banjo at 23-1 improved by 8 points. That would be more of like the improvement. Hog Creek Hustle, Hidden Scroll. I mean, the fact that Hidden Scroll is 2-1 in this race, just like I said before, absolutely blew my mind.
Never be surprised when Hidden Scroll takes money, Spencer. it's a tradition unlike no other. You know, it's like the Masters. But he's an impossible horse to bet. I actually feared him in this spot. He was my second horse just because I thought maybe Brad Cox had figured things out. We've seen it with a horse like K-Nix Go, amongst others, where when Cox, you know, has the keys, he kind of figures out what was wrong with the horse. Just to mention one horse that didn't run well in here but worth a look on a playback, and that's number three, Bango. This horse just does not like to run anywhere other than at Churchill Downs. If you look at it, I mean, the November 26th, the last win, won there at 97 Brisnet speed rating. Churchill three back before that. Did run well at Turfway Park in the Animal Kingdom over the old synthetic. But a horse to keep an eye out on when he runs back at Churchill Downs, because for whatever reason, he likes running under the Twin Spires and doesn't appreciate running very many other places.
It's that same horse for course angle. It's that same feeling you kind of get with all those Southern California horses. I've always talked about how if the East Coast turf horses ship west, you can always usually bet the East Coasters, and the West Coast dirt is usually always better than the East Coast dirt. That's just the way I've kind of looked at it over the last couple of years.
It's worked well for you. A lot of those big races at Del Mar and Santa Anita have been won by Chad Brown horses, amongst other horsemen. And then we definitely know a guy like Bob Baffert has come east with his dirt horses. Michael McCarthy's had a few and taken the big races on the East Coast.
Let's move into our final race of the pod, race number 11, the grade 2 Toyota Bluegrass, 1 1/8 miles on the dirt. For me, it was kind of just a two-horse race. That's kind of how I looked at it, and I did not want to play Essential Quality here just based on price alone.
Yeah, I was all in on Essential Quality, Chalk City for me. I just, when I looked at the race, A, he was the best horse, and B, he was going to get the right trip. Surprisingly, a race of this nature had so little speed signed on. And we know that Essential Quality, when need be, can sit close to the pace. But when he doesn't need to be, he can sit further off it like he did in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile and even in the Southwest. And just thought it was either going to be highly motivated out of the one-turn races that would speed to the lead and Essential Quality would sit second. If for whatever reason, highly motivated like he had in previous races, didn't get out of the gate well, I thought Luis Saez would just take control and be very tough to pass in the lane. So it was Chalk City for me in the Bluegrass.
For me, it was kind of right back to highly motivated. I was going to get a much better price than I got in the Gotham, and I thought if I was to stick with him in the Gotham and thought that Weyburn was just kind of like one of those 1-in-100 type horses, I kind of have to take him here at, you know, 6x the price at 7-2 when Essential Quality is going to take a ton of money. And they had kind of run the same last two races, obviously. Essential Quality had run a 95 and a 96, and it was a 96-92 for highly motivated. And just to get that much bigger of a price difference, I'll ask you kind of the same question I asked Maggie on an earlier podcast, and maybe I've even asked you this before. I kind of feel that when it comes down to the grading of all these stakes races, for two-year-olds, I feel like every single grade stakes should be a grade two until the Breeders' Cup, and obviously the Breeders' Cup Juvenile should be a grade one. And then I feel that, you know, the Florida Derby, certain races being grade ones before the actual Kentucky Derby is just, I understand why for the breeding and all that stuff, but I just think it would make much more sense to just, you know, have a lot of more grade twos out there.
I would be fine if they were all grade twos. I'd also be fine if they were all grade ones, these final championship series races. I know that's not the method to go back and regrade these things, but they're all highly coveted final preps for, you know, the final major preps for the Kentucky Derby. I think to have them at anything other than the same level is problematic. You know, they can tend to run in cycles, but, you know, and obviously some horsemen are going to point for the grade ones for breeding purposes, maybe point for the dollar signs, although the Bluegrass, a grade two, $800,000 race. But for me, it would be uniformity. I would want all of these final races to either be grade one or grade two. I'm not too concerned if they're grade ones, though.
I will say this with highly motivated. Kind of my idea behind putting him on top as well was the fact that Chad decided to put him in the Nyquist there on one of the BC undercards, and he won by 4.5 against the two other horses that came right back to win. Like I had said, that it's always weird that first start off of a layoff for these three-year-olds. Sometimes they need one, and then they pop that second time out. Other times they just pop that first time out, and you just hope you can keep them going. And I just thought, you know, the way New York has obviously been playing, obviously we had the Todd Pletcher $100 horse over there on Saturday as well. It's just, I don't know how strong those preps were, but the fact that Chad also shipped him here to face, and knowing that that Essential Quality was probably going to be here, I thought was very, very positive. I also gave Ron Bauer a little bit of a shot as well. He's a horse that I had played in a big, big ticket on a Breeders' Cup day as well. I just thought this one is one of those that can kind of improve, and was also coming out of, you know, the Santa Anita and Del Mar races, and apparently it seems like all the horses coming out of Southern California right now are, you know, shipping and winning.
Yeah, first in terms of the Chad Brown highly motivated the Keeneland move, it was a weird one. I was surprised that he opted for it. I'm not sure exactly what the thinking was, them, him there, and then Crowded Trade and risk-taking back in New York. It was definitely an interesting move. I still am not highly motivated. To me, just still not 100%. He's a true classic distance horse. And then there, when it comes to the rest of the field, I thought I've been high on Ron Bauer and Hidden Stash as kind of, you know, long shot underneath Derby type horses potentially. But for both of them, it was just the lack of early speed that made them very hard to back. And I thought Untraded could go the right way. Definitely some upside, a very strong maiden breaking score at Tampa Bay Downs. Obviously, the waters were getting a lot more difficult for the Team Valor runner, but a horse I wanted to definitely keep an eye on and continue to do so, even if he ran poorly in the Bluegrass.
In what seemed to be a match race here in the Toyota Bluegrass, Scott has Essential Quality. I am highly motivated. Let's see who gets it done here right now.
And they're off in the Toyota Bluegrass Stakes. There goes Highly Motivated from the inside, right out for the early lead. Essential Quality comes away up close to the outside to challenge for the top spot as they head down to the first turn. Highly Motivated scoots over next to the rail. Essential Quality goes second up on the outside. Rumbauer hugs the rail behind the front pair in third. Hush of a Storm is up close in fourth. Keep Me in Mind toward the outside is in fifth. Sitting on Go is sixth back toward the inside. Hidden Stash seventh. Leblon eighth. Untreated ninth and last as they hit the backstretch. The opening quarter in 23.83 seconds. Highly Motivated the leader. Highly Motivated in front a half length. Essential Quality goes second by a length. Keep Me in Mind is toward the outside in the third position. Hush of a Storm far outside fourth. Rumbauer sneaks up the rail. Fifth to fourth to third. A length and a half off the lead. Sitting on Go. Sixth between horses. Hidden Stash. Leblon Untreated at the back. It was 48.21 seconds. The time for the opening half mile. Highly Motivated the leader. Essential Quality is second. A half length. Separate the top two. Onto the far turn. Rumbauer is third. Keep Me in Mind fourth on the outside. Side. Now taking third ahead, two lengths off the front pair. Hush of a Storm in fifth, Hidden Stash between horses, down toward the inside in sixth, and still six lengths off the lead. Highly Motivated has the lead coming toward the quarter pole. Essential Quality second on the outside, still a half length separate the top two, and they've opened up by seven lengths off the turn to Hidden Stash, who swings wide in third. Here comes Essential Quality now, taking aim once again at Highly Motivated, who still has the lead coming into the final furlong of the Toyota Bluegrass. Highly Motivated with the advantage. Essential Quality is still driving at him from the outside past the 16th pole. Highly Motivated. Essential Quality. What a finish. The champ remains unbeaten. Essential Quality to win it for Luis Saez.
And then number four, Essential Quality guts it out. $3 winner, 97 buyer. I feel like I had my heart ripped out twice. I had passed the champagne in the race two back from here. I think, I might actually get it done here and just right on the wire.
Yeah, both Highly Motivated and Essential Quality ran very well. The champ with the nose for the wire grinded him out. I'm not sure if it was the desire to get more distance than Highly Motivated, whether it's the experience. Who knows? But I'm curious. It'll be interesting to see how Highly Motivated runs as the distances get longer, and as there's a race where he's not the lone speed in a speed, you know, paceless race. Uh-huh. I don't really see that happening very often. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they'll try new tactics moving forward and continue to put him on the lead. But yeah, a kind of a weird race because of the lack of speed. But you just have to tip your cap to the champ now being 5-for-5 and almost certainly will be one of the two favorites come the first Saturday in May, barring unforeseen circumstances.
Two horses that don't really so much give me a headache, but just two that I just seem to be overmatched and just keep ending up in these spots, Sitting on Go and Keep Me in Mind. Obviously, the Deodoro trainee, Keep Me in Mind, has that one solid race at Keeneland in the Breeders' Futurity where he ran a really high 90 buyer. Sitting on Go to me, since the Iroquois as a two-year-old just came back and hasn't even run close to that 84 buyer. I'm not sure what it is on Briz, but just to keep seeing these types of horses enter these races, I mean, maybe down the road, maybe the Oklahoma, the Remington, the Oklahoma Derby, something like that, they might actually end up, you know, waking up and winning. But I mean, it's just almost easy just to see Sitting on Go. I've just crossed the horse. I haven't looked at the PPs anymore.
Yeah, well, Keep Me in Mind, I thought maybe you could give an excuse from the Rebel in a race dominated by the front runners, and it was his first race in a while, and he had some hiccups in training. After this race, I've kind of seen enough of him for now. Maybe an early developing type that took advantage of some, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, a favorable setup. The Kentucky Jockey Club was a weak field. Sitting on Go, I still can't believe I got beat. I like Midnight Bourbon and the Iroquois. I can't believe that horse came from well off of it to get by me. This horse hasn't run a step since that race. And yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, the connections just want to believe that they, you know, you can find excuses for some of these races. Not sure what the excuse was in the Tampa Bay Derby, but I think it's time either for a class drop, which is probably the right move. But if nothing else, maybe a cutback to one turn where he's run his best races.
It would be a shame if I didn't talk to you a little bit about March Madness. How have you been enjoying the tournaments this year? Obviously, we talked about last year. We're not going to get into it anymore. But just how have you enjoyed the tournament so far this year?
It's been great. I didn't get to follow it. I mean, it's usually a big part of my job and work. It was cut out. College basketball wasn't a part of things this year for a number of reasons. So I didn't follow it nearly as closely in the regular season, which was the first time in two or three decades that I didn't know everything about every player and team. So it's been very entertaining and, to be quite honest, less stressful. But there certainly has been some good moments. The UCLA-Gonzaga game in the Final Four was fantastic. And, yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you know, I'm ready for another tournament, you know. but, yeah, championship game tonight as we record this on Monday night. Really looking forward to it.
I obviously, being a diehard Texas fan, I was super excited with us this year. I was excited to get going. I had watched about the first three quarters of that game against Christian Abilene, and I just went to bed, woke up, and we lost by a point, and 2 weeks later, Shaka Smart's out. So, I mean, everyone asked me, they're like, oh, is it Shaka does so well for you? Like, I mean, we haven't won an NCAA tournament game in what seems like 10 years. So, I mean, I'm happy for change. I don't know how much if I want a Texas Tech guy taking over for us, but we'll always have to see down the road with these rivalries and just what happens. I hope Shaka does well elsewhere he goes. I think he was a really good coach for us, and it should be interesting going forward. You know, Texas, it seems, you know, quote-unquote dynasty level, but they're always one of these top-tier teams, and we've been going through so many coaching changes in football and basketball. It'll be very interesting down the line what happens.
Yeah, Shaka Smart, a Madison, Wisconsin native, was once, after when Bo Ryan left Wisconsin, it was a big thought that he might come from VCU to go to Wisconsin instead of our current coach, Greg Gard. But he had an okay run at Texas. I would consider a disappointment. And I just can't figure out for the life of me, Spencer, how a university with everything Texas has to offer, the history, Austin, you know, the conference, I mean, just so much, how it's so hard to put together. You know, it's one thing to win championships, but to be a contender, it should be every year for Texas. I just can't figure out what's going on. Maybe the expectations are just too high down there for whatever reason, but it's definitely an enigma.
That's about all the time we have for today's podcast. I want to thank so much my special guest, Scott Shapiro, for coming on. Scott, where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Spencer, at ScottShap34. And then with the Derby around the corner, I'll be on the Churchill Downs feed and the morning work shows leading up to the big race. And then you can find my selections each and every day on at ChurchillDowns.com, along with Joe Christofek and Ed DeRosa under the Expert Picks tab.
You know, with Derby right around the corner, I'll probably be talking to you sooner rather than later. Thanks again. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks, Spencer.
Thanks again to all the loyal and fabulous listeners here on the In the Money Podcast Network, and also just for those who enjoy Redboard Rewind, I appreciate all of you for all of your insight and just, you know, keeping the views up as high as they can be. And to my special guest, Scott Shapiro, this show has been a production of In the Money Media, and the Money Media's president is Pierre Thomas Fornichel. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kitchen, and our In the Money Media business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Spencer Lugenbuehl, and we will see you next time.